At Occidental, Obama hung out, as he put it, with the more politically active black students, the foreign students, the Chicanos, the Marxist professors and structural feminists and punk rock performance poets. We smoked cigarettes and wore leather jackets. At night, in the dorms, we discussed neocolonialism, France Fanon, Eurocentrism, and patriarchy. In one of his classes, Obama read Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness. He commented to a friend, "See, the book's not really about Africa or black people. It's about the man who wrote it, the European, the American, a particular way of looking at the world. So I read the book to help me understand just what it is that makes white people so afraid. It helps me understand how people learn to hate." As an analysis of Conrad's novella, this is rather jejune. Young Obama doing his best impression of Chinua Achebe. Achebe is the Nobel laureate in literature from Ghana who wrote a famous critique of Heart of Darkness. Achebe's analysis was much more subtle. He recognized that Conrad was a Polish expatriate who viewed colonialism from an angle much more distant and skeptical than that of British writers like Rudyard Kipling. Yet while Achebe found Conrad innocent of the charge of condoning imperialism, he found him guilty of the charge of condoning racism. Conrad saw and condemned the evil of imperial exploitation, but was strangely unaware of the racism on which it sharpened its iron tooth. The case against Conrad, however, is far from settled, even when it is advanced by a figure of Achebe's stature. One of Conrad's leading characters, Marlowe, observes that the conquest of the earth, which mostly means the taking it away from those who have a different complexion or slightly flatter noses than ourselves, is not a pretty thing when you look into it too much. Marlowe is European, and obviously he's speaking from the European point of view. Even so, he makes very clear his distaste for the whole enterprise of declaring other people inferior so that their land can be plundered. Racism in this framework is not about what makes white people afraid or learning to hate, as Obama would have it. Rather, when you overpower other people and take their possessions, racism enables you to justify the appropriation by declaring those others to be inferior. Conrad recognizes the role that racism plays. It justifies Kurtz's ivory trading post. We shouldn't be too hard on Obama for his C-plus analysis of Conrad. In later years, he would receive much better and more personal lessons in the reality of colonial conflict and depression. At Occidental, Obama became active in the student campaign to divest university funds from South Africa. This was Obama's first involvement in student politics, and he spoke at a divestment rally on February 18, 1981. "There's a struggle going on. It's happening an ocean away, but it's a struggle that touches each and every one of us. A struggle that demands we choose sides, not between black and white, not between rich and poor. It's a choice between dignity and servitude, between commitment and indifference." Those who listened carefully to Obama's words that evening would have realized he was speaking a different political language than the other speakers. They viewed South Africa through the prism of American racial conflict. Presuming a close analogy between Southern segregation and South African apartheid, they interpreted the South African struggle in civil rights terms. And this is how several scholarly studies, such as George Frederickson's White Supremacy, have typically treated the subject. But Obama's perspective was wider. He recognized that the South African struggle was only incidentally an issue of black and white. Primarily, it was a struggle between the colonizers and the colonized. South Africa had been settled by white Europeans, the Dutch in the 17th century and the English in the 19th century. In the 20th century, the Afrikaners, the descendants of the Dutch and French Huguenot settlers, herded much of the majority black population into separate homelands called Bantustans. Apartheid was established not merely for social and political separation, but also to enable the Afrikaners to exploit cheap black labor. This was how Obama viewed the issue, as the anti-colonial resistance struggle of his own day. For Obama, the racism issue could be understood from inside the larger issue of colonial subjugation. Given the anti-colonial significance of the South Africa debate, it's easy to see why Obama seized upon this issue, ignoring other hot-button issues of the time, such as campus bigotry and affirmative action. Two of Obama's closest friends at Occidental were Pakistani students Muhammad Hassan Chandu and Wahid Hamid. "I think that one of the reasons he felt comfortable with us," Hamid subsequently told a journalist, "is that we didn't come with a lot of predispositions about race. We weren't carrying that American baggage. We were brown, and we got along with people who were white and black." In the summer of 1981, Obama visited his mother and half-sister Maya in Indonesia. But before that, he visited Chandu and Hamid in Pakistan. Chandu's girlfriend at the time, Margot Mifflin, said that Obama returned from Pakistan amazed at how the peasants bowed to the landowners in respect as they passed. Hamid added, "We went to rural Sindh, where the feudal system is still strong. Barack could see how the owner lives and how the serfs and workers are so subservient." Surely these dichotomies contributed to Obama's developing perspective on the world. That fall, despite his mediocre grades at Occidental, Obama transferred to Columbia University. Oddly, not much is known about Obama at Columbia. Graduates of Columbia from that period say they never encountered Obama either in their classes or socially. The New York Times attempted to track down people who knew Obama at Columbia, but without success. The Times reported that Obama himself declined repeated requests to talk about his New York years, release his Columbia transcript, or identify even a single fellow student, coworker, roommate, or friend from those years. We do know a couple of people who taught Obama at Columbia. One of them was Edward Said. Before his death in 2003, Said was the leading American champion of the Palestinian cause. As a consequence of his advocacy of armed resistance against Israel, the magazine Commentary dubbed him Professor of Terror. Said is also the author of influential anti-colonial works such as Orientalism and Culture and Imperialism. He seems to have had a lasting influence on Obama. Some of Obama's writings are highly resonant with Said's themes and arguments. Also, as I mentioned in an earlier chapter, during his rising years in Chicago politics, Obama attended a Palestinian event in Chicago at which Said was the dinner speaker. Even so, nowhere does Said's name appear in any of Obama's writings or speeches. As far as public Obama is concerned, Said does not exist. At Columbia, Obama wrote an article in a student weekly, Sundial, calling for an end to the U.S. military-industrial complex. Obama's article was a response to the so-called nuclear freeze movement that was sweeping American campuses at the time. As an undergraduate at Dartmouth in the early 1980s, I remember well the paranoia of the freeze activists, who seemed convinced that the world was about to end unless their nuclear freeze solution was immediately implemented. Calling, as it did, for a reciprocal freeze in U.S. and Soviet nuclear arsenals, the freeze was a liberal cause, but apparently not liberal enough for Obama. For him, the issue came down to the big bad military-industrial complex and its irrational, insatiable desire for more costly weapons. Generally, the narrow focus of the freeze movement, as well as academic discussions of first versus second strike capabilities, suit the military-industrial interests as they continue adding to their billion-dollar erector sets. Obama's arrival at Harvard Law School in Cambridge, Massachusetts in the fall of 1988 followed brief stints of community organizing work in New York and Chicago. Wonder why Obama went to Harvard? Here is a clue. It is the leading academic institution in America. And here's another. His father went there. By the time Obama went to Cambridge, he was 27 and older than his peers. This maturity helped Obama win the elections for editor of the Harvard Law Review. It was a densely packed contest, and Obama was one of many candidates jostling for the position. The story goes that Obama won by convincing the conservatives to vote for him. The conservatives were impressed because here was a Black American who did not seem preoccupied with race. They got a glimmer, but probably did not fully appreciate the extent to which Obama's central concern wasn't race, but power. He was merely playing along with Black identity politics in order to fit in and find a constituency for himself. Still, Obama applied a certain work ethic to the task of being Black. He joined the board of directors of the Black Law Students Association. He presented himself to his professors as a champion of the African American cause, earning major brownie points and inspiring one of his teachers, the legal scholar Lawrence Tribe, to later proclaim Obama the best student I ever had. One of his professors, civil rights advocate Charles Ogletree, said Obama came well steeped in the history of the civil rights movement and wanted to know even more. Obama's eagerness to make common cause with African Americans even moved him to get involved in the bizarre Derrick Bell controversy. Bell threatened to resign from the Harvard Law faculty if the university didn't increase minority hiring. Bell specifically demanded the immediate recruitment of a woman of color. At a time when Blacks could do virtually no wrong at Harvard, when the university was doing pirouettes and backward somersaults to please Blacks, Bell somehow convinced himself that racism is an integral, permanent, and indestructible component of this society, and that Harvard was a big part of the problem. What was Bell's evidence for this? Actually, he had none, so instead, Bell drew on his imagination. One of his stories, The Space Traders, envisioned hordes of whites seeking to round up Blacks and subject them to a Holocaust. Some Blacks survive, however, and they are chased down to be sold into slavery to aliens from outer space. Crazy stuff. Obama must surely have recognized the fatuousness of Bell's claims, especially at Harvard. Even so, he spoke in measured tones in defense of Bell. Nobody recalls precisely what he said, but Rosa Parks was mentioned, and everyone present concluded that Obama was a regular soul brother. Harvard went to considerable lengths to placate Bell, but he could not be placated and left Harvard for New York University. Still, Obama saw how Bell's antics were taken with utmost seriousness by everyone on campus. Obama seems to have recognized that race was now a source of power in American society. Somehow whites had been shamed by the nation's past into conceding to Blacks a kind of unquestioned moral superiority. The Tunisian writer Albert Memmi makes a similar point in The Colonizer and the Colonized. Memmi's argument is that over time, colonization wears down the conscience of the oppressor. He is a privileged being and an illegitimately privileged one, that is, a usurper. Furthermore, this is not so only in the eyes of the colonized, but in his own as well. Something analogous can be said about racism. It has convinced whites, no less than Blacks, that whites have been the beneficiaries of unearned privileges. Thus, whites now recognize Blacks as America's de facto racial experts, and anything Blacks say, however preposterous, is typically agreed to or at least greeted with deference. Here was a source of power that a clever fellow could later exploit. Although Obama schmoozed all the liberal professors at Harvard, his real mentor was Roberto Mangabeira Unger. Born in Rio de Janeiro to a Brazilian mother and a German father, Unger is perhaps the leading anti-colonial scholar in the field of legal studies. A few years ago, Unger took a leave of absence from Harvard to serve in the executive office of Brazilian President Lula da Silva. Lula was reputed to be anti-American and also a socialist, but when he turned out to be pro-American and a moderate, Unger called for Lula's impeachment. Not surprisingly, Lula sent Unger back to Harvard. This was in 2009. While Obama was at Harvard in the late 1980s, Unger was associated with the critical legal studies movement. These scholars were dubbed crits. According to the crits, law pretends to be fair and neutral, but it is really a sham. It is politics by other means. Legal structures are merely a camouflage for keeping entrenched interests in power. What's needed is to topple these interests and replace them, and law can serve this transformative end as well. There were several crits at Harvard, though Unger eventually broke with the movement because he considered its approach too limited and ineffective. Unger's own vision was much more comprehensive and revolutionary. He calls his perspective total criticism. Basically, this means using the law to pull down the existing power structures and replace them with alternative power structures more reflective of third world and minority interests. One of Unger's proposals, which he advances in the name of empowering democracy, is for the government to seize all private capital and place it into a capital fund that would be allocated by teams of workers and citizens. Come to think of it, Unger's proposal sounds a lot like the 1965 paper of Barack Obama Sr. Obama took two of Unger's courses, one on jurisprudence and another on reinventing democracy. Obama's attraction to Unger's work is obvious. Obama said he went to Harvard Law School because it was the perfect place to examine how the power structure works. Unger showed him not only how to examine it, but also how to dismantle it through the instruments of law. So what does Obama say about Unger in his speeches and writings? Nothing. Like Edward Said, Unger has simply disappeared from Obama's official record, and not because his influence was minor. In fact, quite the opposite. Even after Obama left Harvard, leaving his other admiring liberal professors behind, he continued to communicate with Unger all the way up to the presidential campaign. One or two enterprising reporters did find out about Unger and attempted to contact him. Unger, however, refused to talk to anyone in the press about his pupil and protege, giving David Remnick his simple reason. Unger confessed, "I am a leftist, and by conviction as well as by temperament, a revolutionary. Any association of mine with Barack Obama in the course of the campaign could only do harm." By the early 1990s, Obama was a very different man from the impressionable, badass kid who had come to the East Coast from the western shores of Hawaii and California. Still, his background and his memories shaped him. His understanding had been heightened by leading anti-colonial thinkers such as Edward Said and Roberto Unger. But now he had an additional plus. He had found a way to pass as a Black American and to integrate himself into the civil rights experience. This was hardly his experience, but even that worked to Obama's benefit. His distance gave the impression of intellectual detachment and objectivity, and thus was interpreted by others as maturity. As the first Black president of the Harvard Law Review, Obama even enjoyed a minor celebrity, which brought him his first book contract. Thus, having studied the world, Obama was now ready to go out and change it. This audiobook is continued on Disc 4.